When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And free 2-day shipping. Shop today and get the best deal ever.
Where's my rocket pack, Secord?
You gotta let me use it one more time.
I'm tired of square dancing with you, kid. I could slap you with grand theft, treason, espionage, and that's just my short list.
Willie, give me the cuffs. No, look, they got my girl.
Ah, oh, God, Cliff, no.
Yeah, they set up a rendezvous. They want to swap Jenny for the rocket.
Look, kid, I understand how you feel, but you've got to let us handle this.
I got to go alone, or they're going to kill her. I'll give you your rocket back. Tomorrow, I swear.
Hey, this ain't negotiation. Those guys are playing for keeps.
I can handle Valentine.
The Valentine gang is only hired muscle. They're working for a Nazi agent. Someone we think is highly placed in Hollywood society. Someone our intrepid G-men have been unable to identify.
It's Neville Sinclair.
What?
It's Neville Sinclair.
Come on.
Yeah, sure, it makes perfect sense. That's why he was bossing Eddie's men around at the Saucese Club. That's why he has Jenny.
Nice try, kid. We're taking him downtown and we're locking him up.
We'll take it from here, Mr. Hughes. Let's go, kid.
Hey!
No guns!
Son of a bitch will fly.
Welcome to the Superhero Cinephiles podcast. I'm your host, Perry Constantine, and welcoming a new guest, and that is fellow author Ed Ertelak. Ed, how you doing today?
Hey, Perry. Thanks for having me. I'm doing well. How you doing?
I'm doing good. Thanks for coming on. So what I like to do with new guests is to give them a chance to introduce themselves to the audience, tell them a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Yeah. Okay. So as Perry said, my name is Ed Ertelak. I am an author of 15 novels. I'm most known for a Macabre Rider series. It was a weird Western I did of four books about a Hasidic gunslinger traveling through the Old West, kind of fighting demons and tracking the renegade master who betrayed his mystic order of astral travelers to the great old ones of the Cthulhu mythos. So I was born in Indiana, educated in Chicago. I came out here to Los Angeles in about 2000, 1999, trying to do screenwriting. Didn't have a lot of luck at it. Kind of switched in a roundabout way to novels. And as I said, I've published 15 so far. Dozens of short stories placed here and there. I did a independent movie, a Western back in 2009 called Meaner Than Hell. You can check that out on Amazon streaming. And that's what brings me here today.
Okay, very cool. So before we jump too much into current stuff, why don't you tell people a little bit about how you got into superheroes, comic books, anything like that?
The first comic books I probably read, I couldn't even read. I was just looking at the pictures. You know, I think I had one of those giant-sized Treasury Edition Werewolf by Nights is one of the first things I remember reading, and it had, like, Spider-Man in it. I think I begged for it because Spider-Man was on it, and they had that, you know, that TV show in the 70s or early 80s. I can't remember guy's name, but it was a Spider-Man show and everything, and so I was heavy into Spider-Man, and I would make up the stories as I went along. So then I got that Werewolf by Night became the first title I kind of collected because sort of like Mr. Glass in Unbreakable, my mom would kind of coax me to get my grades better every week by like she got a big old stack of Werewolf by Nights from some flea market or something. And she would like give me an issue a week if I, you know, did all right in school that week and everything. So that was the first series I had a full run of and everything. And superheroes. I can remember watching the Shazam show, like where the one where he was, you know, traveling around in the Winnebago and stuff in the 70s. And of course, Superman, you know, Batman from the TV show and Christopher Reeve Superman. And from, you know, it just kind of branched out from there. I started collecting G.I. Joe comics. Was it one of the first big ones I was into? Sergio Aragone's Gru the Wanderer was a big one. I think it was Doug Murray did the Nam. I got real into that Vietnam comic that Marvel put out for like, it was like an 8-year limited series. Mm-hmm. Got into that and just spread out from there. I got to be a comics fan in the 90s, right in that age where like, it was just a great time to be a comics fan. Like all those reimaginings of superheroes were coming out, like Dark Knight Returns and The Killing Joke and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so, yeah, that's where my comic book stuff came from. I was a big Captain America fan. Yeah, that's probably where all that came from. And movies, I was always a movie watcher. I think I watched a lot of genre stuff from Son of Svengoolie in Chicago. Mm-hmm. They had horror stuff every Saturdays or Sundays or something. All the Godzilla movies, all the Hammer movies, Universal Horror. And yeah, so it just kind of all stemmed from childhood and kept on going. I got arrested, yeah. I guess.
Yeah, I grew up in the Northwest suburbs, so I definitely remember Svengoolie growing up as well.
Okay, yeah, I was in Cal City, south suburbs over there, yeah.
Okay, yeah, I was up in, it was Northwest Burbs, Des Plaines, Arlington Heights, Park Ridge area is where I was. You said you went to school in Chicago. Where'd you go to school in, by the way?
I went to Columbia College on Michigan over there. Yeah, I went for film and stuff.
I know a lot of people who went there. I unfortunately could not convince my parents to help me pay for Columbia, though. So they're like, you got to go to a real school. So that's what they told me.
You probably got more out of school than I did, honestly, at a real school. Like, I did not use the film degree to get me anything except like temp jobs and stuff. So.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that's how it goes. But anyway, so we're going to talk about today's pick is The Rocketeer. But before we talk about that, what are you into these days? Is there anything you're watching, you're reading that's kind of grabbing your attention right now?
I don't know about genre wise. Like I got heavy. The latest thing I've been watching, crazy enough, is the Wu-Tang Clan American Saga on Hulu. It's kind of this stylized imagining of the getting together of the rap group Wu-Tang and everything in New York, and they do these really interesting takes on the ways the albums are assembled and stuff. Like they do riffs on like they did a for Old Dirty Bastard had a 70s era kind of blaxploitation episode where he was like this kind of blaxploitation hero that was out to kill like a he was hired to assassinate like a an android version of android double of the guy that ran Soul Train.
I can't remember.
It's pretty crazy. It's really out there. They have Kung Fu centric episodes. They did one that was like The Killing, the killer John Woo with the pigeons flying around and everything. And it's very fun. Yeah. It's not what you think, like from the ads and stuff. That's very fun. It's fun for like a movie watcher and stuff to kind of go and get all the references. There's like a New Jack City episode, you know, from the 90s. They got one set in the 80s and stuff. And it's very interesting. It's very interesting because it kind of shows how they pull their influences from like Chang Cheh 70s, like Kung Fu movies and from Shogun Assassin and stuff and how they pull all their elements together in creating their music and everything. That's pretty fun. I watch a lot of horror and stuff, mainly with my daughter. My daughter's a big horror hound. We go to Monster Palooza every year and all that. I'm trying to think of the last thing I saw, though. I think it was probably, I watched that show Swarm, which was about an obsessed kind of Beyonce fan or something that was going around slaughtering people that didn't like her.
I haven't heard of it.
It's really crazy. Really crazy. Dominique Fishback, I think, is the actress in it.
Oh, she was in what was it? Project Power, right?
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. We covered that a while back. One of the last films Derek and I talked about on the show, actually.
Oh, Derek. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, he was the original co-host of this before he passed for the first 60 episodes or so.
Oh, he's a good guy. He's a great guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I still go back and listen to those old episodes when he was on. So it's a nice way to keep him alive in memory and all that. But anyway, Today we are talking about The Rocketeer, 1991 movie directed by Joe Johnston, adapted from the comic book by Dave Stevens. What's your history with this character? Have you ever read the Dave Stevens comics?
I sought out the Dave Stevens comic because of this movie, because I was such a fan of this movie. Like, I loved this movie from the get-go, and I went out and found the comics. They were kind of hard to get a hold of at one point and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to admit, maybe it's dependent on, like, what you come to first and everything, kind of like, you know, Robert E. Howard Conan, your estimation of the Schwarzenegger movie kind of rises and falls according to if you saw it first, or if you read his stuff first, or if you read the Roy Thomas comics first or something. And in this case, I prefer the movie to the books, to the comic. The comic is beautifully illustrated. But it's got this kind of like, I know Jenny is pretty much Betty Page in the comic and everything.
Yeah,
and it's got a little bit of a cheesecake feel to it and everything. And it's not quite as, wholesome as the movie is and everything. It's good. It's very good. But yeah, I really prefer the movie, honestly. But again, I came to it first. So
yeah, I never read the comics, but I was just doing some research on it last night. And yeah, they are now all available. I think it's IDW has a collection, like the Rocketeer Adventures or something like that. But if you search on Amazon, it's like all in one volume, because he didn't do a lot of it. It was just like a very, you know, these little short stories here and there, because he was primarily working in like film and animation, and comics was just kind of like this hobby for him. And mm-hmm. like you said, it's beautifully illustrated. He spent a lot of time on detail. So it took him a while to get these stories out there. So you're not talking about a whole wealth of backlog material if you're interested in finding the Dave Stevens stuff. In fact, I think that there's probably more stuff done by other creators who are not Dave Stevens based on The Rocketeer as opposed to stuff that he did. But
the major
I was going to say
the major difference between it for me, I said like the Betty Page character is actually obviously based on the real pinup, you know, model Betty Page and everything. And he kind of depicts her. He uses a lot of excuses to depict her imperiled and everything, you know, like tied up and in some kind of bondage thing and everything. And so it's a little bit seedy to me and everything, but it's still a beautiful comic, and it looks really cool. The other big difference was in the movie, the inventor of the rocket is Howard Hughes. But in the comic, he used thinly disguised Doc. Oh my God, I'm blanking
Doc
on his
Savage,
name.
Yeah.
Doc Savage, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I read about that too. That they, you know, they it was obviously supposed to be Doc Savage. They never mention him directly, and they never show him completely, but they kind of hint at it. They've got like his team
his
there with it. So
Monk
yeah,
is
yeah,
there
so,
and all those guys. Yeah.
Right. So it's pretty heavily indicated that it is Doc Savage, which the movie obviously had to change to Howard Hughes. And we'll talk about Howard Hughes and Terry O'Quinn's performance in this, because I really enjoyed that aspect of it.
Yeah,
of it too.
He's great.
But yeah, most of what I had read about the comic books, because I'd never read them myself, very similar in line with what you were saying. A lot of people were saying like, yeah, the movie kind of streamlines and improves a lot of it. And the Betty Page stuff is interesting, because he writes her name in the comic as Betty with a Y, whereas, you know, the real Betty Page spelled it with IE. And there's an interesting idea that, because he sent these likenesses he did of Betty Page to the real Betty Page, and
she didn't approve
it with her. No, she
but
did
she didn't approve it.
Not for this movie, not for this movie, but she did like it in the comic book, and she gave his, and he had like sent her a check or something to pay for his use of her likeness when he found out that she was still alive. And then they had struck up a friendship, and he had said in an interview that it was kind of weird that he grew up like idolizing her, and now he's driving her around to pick up her social security checks and that kind of stuff.
That's really cool.
When the movie came out, they did ask Betty Page about using her name, and she would not allow it to be used for the movie. So then they changed it.
I wonder if she asked for. Did she ask for like a check, a bigger check from like, you know, the studios or something, and didn't get it or something? Or?
I mean, that would make sense, because it was, it was Disney. So, but it just says in the trivia that she would not allow her name to be used in the film. So I'm not sure exactly what the negotiations were, what the story was behind it, but I think maybe she was more okay with it being in a comic book, because it's got a much lower audience, and because, you know, she had never even known about the comic book at all. She had never known that her likeness was in this comic book. And whereas movies are a much bigger thing. And by that point, you know, she's what, in her 70s at the time this movie came out. I think, you know, she's probably kind of done with, doesn't really care much about her likeness being used, or is not really interested in that being what she's remembered for anymore. Or it could be any number of reasons, but yeah. Mm-hmm. Now me, I saw this movie in the theater. I remember seeing it in 1991 when I was like, 8 years old or something, in the, 7 or 8 years old, in the theater, and just loving it when I saw it the first time. And years later, just rediscovering it on DVD. And it's one of those things where you see a movie like this when you're a kid, it grabs your attention. And then when you're an adult and you try and go back and watch it again, there's usually one of two reactions you have. It's either, oh my God, this is bad. What was I thinking? Yeah. And the other one's like, wow, this actually still holds together pretty
damn well. This really holds up,
And
yeah, for me, it's the latter for sure.
Same here. Yeah. Same here. Yeah. I mean, this movie holds together very well. I mean, I've got some minor quibbles with it. Mainly, I do wish that we had seen more Rocketeer, actually, is probably the biggest complaint I have about this movie. But otherwise, it still holds together really well. It's a lot of fun.
He spends a lot of time on the ground, for being the Rocketeer and everything.
Like, right, yeah.
Sometimes the rocket is just shooting him across the South Seas Club, you know, on a tray and everything, but on a dolly. But it really does hold up. I didn't see it in the theater. I remember the commercials, and I think I started working in a video store in the mid-90s or something, and I think that's where I first watched it. Like, I just took it home and was like, oh, this is one of those things, you know, you all of a sudden I was everything that I had always wanted to see and didn't get a chance to. It was available to me for free, so I was taking home tapes all the time. And I definitely saw this on video first, and I loved it. It was really good. I don't know what it is about this movie. There's something I don't know how you can be nostalgic for things you never knew, you know, but people like, I guess that's where like Indiana Jones, you know, comes in. It's definitely got that Indiana Jones like color palette and feel. In the mid-80s or late-80s, they were doing a lot of like Tucker Man and His Dream, I guess before that they did Chinatown. You know, a lot of those kind of 70s, 80s, 90s Hollywood looks back at the 30s, and it got me into it. It was not an era that I was familiar with, except, you know, through my dad. My dad was a big World War II buff, but there's something really like I said, nostalgic about it, which is weird to say, because, you know, I said I'm not familiar with any of that stuff like personally, but it's really American. It's very I wonder how it plays with like Europeans, you know, or like just somebody from not America. Like, I've never really spoken to anybody else about that and asked how it goes with them.
I actually do have some input on that stuff, because first off, I get what you're saying about the nostalgic for things that you were never really there to experience the first time. Cause I had that too. And I think probably, my dad's probably very similar. I was born later in my dad's life. So my dad and yours are probably around the same generation. But like, you know, I got into a lot of the stuff like Indiana Jones, you know, The Rocketeer, this movie, James Bond, a lot of that came from my dad's influence, because that was the stuff he experienced growing up and that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I think there's definitely something to that, like, you know, getting nostalgic for things that you inheriting nostalgia from your parents, I guess, in a way. But I will say that, you know, this movie, it didn't do well when it came out in the theaters. It it was kind of a financial flop, but it became very popular afterwards. Like, I think it earned more on home video, just in rentals, than it did in the actual theater. About half as much. But it was a commercial disappointment, and it had developed a really big cult following over the years, because even though it wasn't financially successful, it became very popular in America, and surprisingly also in Japan. It became very popular in Japan, apparently, which was funny, because I was watching this last night. Yeah, I mean, this movie actually came out before my wife was born. So when I was watching it last night, I told her what it is. She's like, I don't think that's ever come out in Japan. I've never heard of it before. But I looked it up later. It turns out that, it actually had a big following here in Japan as well.
He has kind of a Japanese look, I guess, with the helmet and everything. You know, he looks like Ultraman or something. So
yeah, you're right. I am seeing that now. It does have that kind of thing. And I think that might have played something into it, especially if you're looking at like my favorite version of the poster is like the Art Deco poster, which I mean,
his arms like at his sides, and it's kind of he's kind of streaking, and it does. Right. He's like, in profile, it's really cool.
You're right. It's got a very tokusatsu feel to it. Yeah, Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's, and we've talked about this before on this show, but the 90s were an interesting time for superhero movies because it's this post Batman 89 era. Hollywood still doesn't quite know what to make of superhero movies, where it's like, you know, well, obviously there's an audience for this, but we don't really take it seriously. Plus, yeah, we don't really have the budget to do it in live action. So there was kind of this weird period where instead of going after a lot of the big superhero properties, they were instead going after these more pulpish properties. So you had like The Shadow, you know, mm-hmm. The Rocketeer, The Phantom. And that was kind of like the big trilogy of these, the big trinity of these characters that came out in the 90s. And I always say it's kind of funny looking back at it because, and we had covered The Shadow and The Phantom on previous episodes. And of those three, like, I think I've always said that The Rocketeer is like far and away the best one of those three. The Phantom,
yeah, it is. I'm surprised this wasn't covered and those were. It's kind of funny.
Yeah,
when I saw that this was open, I was like, oh, I love this movie. Let's talk about it.
It's very interesting. Yeah, the types of movies that people suggest on here, because there are some big holes that haven't been filled in here. Like, for example, I always say that nobody's asked to come on to talk about The Dark Knight, for example, which...
Yeah, that's crazy. Wow, that's huge. Yeah. I mean, maybe it's just because those are such well-worn territory, you know? People have talked, you know, endlessly about those online, just on Facebook and stuff. They just feel like they don't have anything new to say or something. And who knows? Maybe I don't have anything to say about The Rocketeer, but I just love gushing about this movie. It's literally my favorite superhero movie.
I think another part of it is just people probably just assume, well, obviously you've talked about that. It's one of the biggest ones. So so sometimes they'll just go for the more obscure stuff just out of reflex.
Yeah, fill the niche. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And so like this is far and away the best of those, that trinity of 90s pulp movies. This is far and away the best. The Phantom, it's got some charms. It's got some very good things in it. You know, Catherine Zeta-Jones is great in it. Billy Zane is great in it. The story's mostly good, but then you've got like Treat Williams and Christy Swanson, who are awful. And so it's a bit of a mixed bag. The Shadow is just very, it's very rough. It's rough to watch.
Yeah, The Shadow is, it's Russell Mulcahy, right? The Shadow, it's got some cool stuff.
I think so, yeah.
That invisible building, I love the invisible skyscraper in The Shadow. That's really cool. But I don't know. It just doesn't land like this does.
No, it doesn't. Yeah.
Intended. It's got a lot of bad landings in it, but it lands pretty well.
Yeah, I think a big part of that is Joe Johnston. Also Billy Campbell, I think is his name. He plays Cliff.
Great, yeah.
Yeah. They're both fans of the original. I mean, Joe Johnston is such a fan of pulp stuff. You can see that in this movie. You can see, I mean, he worked on Indiana Jones. Dave Stevens, I believe, also worked on some of the Indiana Jones movies as well. So I'm not sure if there were, I didn't see anything in the trivia, but I do wonder if they had had some connection on those films, if they had had some interaction. They both have this kind of, these interests, it's more likely than not that they would have, you know, geeked out about this stuff on the set of Indiana Jones.
Yeah, the seeds of it were planted, like, you know, over the catering table at Raiders of the Lost Ark or something.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, Joe Johnson, he then went on to do, you know, Captain America: The First Avenger, which is like very much a pulp superhero film. So it's very, I mean, they picked the perfect director to do that kind of movie set in World War II.
Yeah, I actually saw this recently again on screen. Buddy and I went to the Egyptian down in Hollywood because Johnson was there. Kevin Smith presented it, and like they had him, they had a Q&A of him there. I think it was right before the Blu-ray came out, and they did The Rocketeer. It was right before First Avenger was coming out and everything.
Oh, nice!
So it was really cool. Really cool to see.
Yeah, and this is, let's dig into the movie a little bit. What are some things that really kind of stand out to you rewatching this all these years later?
The score was the first thing I was thinking about. As soon as the beginning credits come up, it sounds like it's James Horner. I love James Horner. I love Glory. That's one of my favorite scores of all time. He does this. You're in all black and the titles are coming up and you're in this, you see the hangar doors kind of open up to the planes and everything. And it sounds like the music you would listen to if you went to the Smithsonian, to the Aeronautics Museum or something, and you were in one of the, like, you're in one of the amphitheaters kind of listening to kind of watching like a thing on the history of flight or something. It's very sweeping and kind of nostalgic, and it makes you think of like propellers and antique planes and biplanes and P-38s and stuff and everything. It actually reminds me of later when I saw Winter Soldier, when he goes into the Smithsonian, you know, Cap, and he's got that, you know, the Captain America exhibit, and they're playing like music, and the guy is like narrating his life and everything, and the kid sees him and all that, and, you know, he tells him to shush and all this. And, it reminds me of that. It's very like kind of low key in the beginning, and then it gets in the action sequences. It has a very distinctive da-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na. They speed it up, and it's very rousing. You know, it's a really cool score. I love the score for this. I mentioned the Indiana Jones color palette too. Yeah, that's something that stands out to me. The all the beige and, you know, oiled leather and stuff, and you know, wood and everything. I could smell this movie almost. You know what I mean?
You know, that is something funny. I realized watching this last night. I'm like, I don't think Cliff ever wears anything different than just this aviator's outfit throughout the entire movie.
He's got that awesome coat. Yeah, he's got the coat.
It is a cool coat. Yeah, but I'm just like wondering. I'm like, man, I wonder if he's even washed those pants or that shirt at all.
Yeah, and that one crash he has in the beginning, like when the oil is spraying from the instrument panel in his face and everything, he's like a total mess. But he's always got that jacket on. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, with the score, something that surprised me when I watched this film each time is that the score and like the color palette and like the design, it all makes it feel like this is supposed to be a much more larger scale story than it actually is. Because when you think about it, the story is actually pretty small scale in comparison to all that other stuff.
Yeah, the airfield, the club, and you know, at the end, the big set pieces, you know, Griffith Observatory and everything.
Yeah, it goes pretty fast. Like, I was kind of surprised when I was rewatching again last night, because I'm just like, oh wow, it's like, you know, we're already at the end. We're almost at the end. It's like, oh, there's that scene at the club, and you know, he tells her she's the Rocketeer. And I remember as a kid thinking like, how did you miss this the whole thing? And then watching it now, I'm like, no, it actually makes sense, because he's only appeared like one time, and it was like that day.
And she's been on a date the whole day with like Neville Sinclair. So she was like, yeah, I don't know what you're talking. I love that bit though, when he kind of grins a little bit right before he says it, like, oh, this is going to be cool. I'm actually like going to tell her I'm this like this famous persona, and she has no idea who he is. She's like, what are you talking? The Rock of who? It's great.
Yeah. I love that part. I really love the performances in this too. One of my favorite moments in this is Eddie Valentine, who's played by Paul Sorvino.
He's awesome. He's got all the best lines. He's so great.
One of my favorite moments is when he finds out Sinclair is a Nazi, and you know, he delivers that great line.
I can't even talk about that scene. Yeah, without swelling up. Yeah, that's starting to like get teary eyed. I love it.
I know. He's like, I may not make an honest buck, but I'm 100% American, and you know,
and I don't work for no two-bit Nazi. And they all turn on the Nazis. It's so great. Such a great line. Yeah.
And that was actually based, reflected in real life. That was a nod to how real life American gangsters had acted. Because Mussolini had persecuted Sicilian families, and then obviously Jewish mobsters would have been against Hitler. And they were organized crime was some of the biggest allies against the American government when it came out to finding Nazi spies.
Yeah, they totally supported the war effort and everything. Well, like in Godfather, I mean, you know, how proud they are of Michael because he's a war hero and all this stuff and everything. Sorvino was so awesome in this movie. Like, I love the bit where they turn on the Nazis, and then the G-men roll up, and they're kind of like, at one point, Sorvino and the G-men are like shooting their Tommy gun side by side, and they look at each other like, oh, this is unique, you know, unique situation. He kind of grins, and then they go back to shooting and everything. It's so cool.
Man, I love Jennifer Connelly in this too. Like, she is. I mean, first off, they made her out look very, very much like Betty Page in this.
But somehow better for me. Like there's a wholesome element to her in this. It's very movie star quality. There's this scene, like, speaking of how great she looks in this and everything, right after she's taken hostage on the Zeppelin, right after Sinclair says, oh, we got the girl, the rocket's going to come to us. There's this shot of her being held by, I think, Lothar, the big guy. And it's just in the dark. It's kind of in the dark, but the floodlights of Griffith Park kind of pass over her face. And she's in blazing soft white lighting, and her eyes are glistening. And she's breathtaking in that shot. And everything. It's like really beautiful. Yeah.
Oh, she's one of my favorite actresses. Like, she's so talented, and you know, she's so beautiful too. And And yeah, she's also got this, she's got the perfect look for a movie like this. Like her,
yeah.
She looks like a 1930s movie star.
She looks like Nozart in this movie, yeah.
And then, you know, Timothy Dalton as Neville Sinclair, which I love too, right. The fact they have, because I don't think this was in the comic book, if I'm not mistaken. He's basically kind of a nod he's basically supposed to be Errol Flynn, because there were these rumors that Errol Flynn was a fascist sympathizer.
Sympathies and stuff. Yeah, which is really cool. I mean, they even have him in the Adventures of Robin Hood. Like, it looks exactly like the set when he's fighting up the stairs, the one guy and everything, in that one scene they shoot and everything. He's got the same, you know, clothes on, the same, you know, color as Robin Hood from 39 and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, he's definitely supposed to be Errol Flynn. He's really great in it too. Yeah, he's very like mustache twiddly at points and everything. I love the bit where he's trying to seduce her and he's just using lines from his movies, and she's such a movie fan that she's like picking them all out and stuff. Oh, you said that in to like Carol Lombard or something on top of the Empire State Building in such and such a movie, and it's pretty funny.
Yeah. But yeah, apparently Errol Flynn had said that what was it? Herman Urban was the greatest influence on his life. And Urban was a dangerous Nazi operatives during World War II. And he was a Nazi spy, even though he was half Jewish. And so there've been these rumors persistent even to this day that Flynn was a Nazi sympathizer. He had had expressions of anti-Semitism. And there's like there's a lot of differing accounts of this about whether or not he was a Nazi sympathizer. And there was a lot of that happening in America at the time.
A lot of guys were, yeah. Mm-hmm. Disney and, you know, it was just funny because it's kind of funny that they use Errol Flynn and kind of paint him as a Nazi sympathizer when Disney was kind of like a known kind of friend to that. Henry Ford, I mean, and Errol Flynn. That's too bad. I love Errol Flynn so much, but go ahead.
There was I'm not sure if you ever saw Family Guy, but I remember there's this one bit, and it's mixed, but I remember there's one bit when there's like this scene where I can't remember, like they wake up Walt Disney from cryo sleep, and they're like, "Welcome back, Mr. Disney." He's like, "Are the Jews gone yet?" And they're like, "No." And he's like, "Put me back to sleep," or something like that. Terrible, fucking terrible. But that's true to life. That's who Walt Disney was. He was a notorious.
Yeah,
you know, he was, fucking terrible for the house on Un-American Activity. He's a total bastard.
Yeah,
so it's kind of funny that Disney is the one who ends up making this movie.
Yeah, put this out, right. The little cameos by, people impersonating old stars are pretty cool. The guy that plays W.C. Fields is great. Clark Gable kind of shoulders past at one point and stuff. And, there's neat cameos by like Clint Howard, I noticed, showed up as a maitre d', just blink and you'll miss him real quick and stuff at the club and everything. And I love the guy that plays the big, Lothar, the big henchman. He's kind of based on a guy that was kind of the face of Universal horror movies for a while in the 30s. Played the Creeper, a guy named Rondo, what's his name? Rondo Hatton. He sounds like a character on The Mandalorian or something. But he had that... he had this kind of gigantism and stuff. And so his face actually looked like that and everything. And he actually appears in the movie at the point where Cliff loses control right after he saves the clown, the wing walking scene. And he's kind of blazing through that cornfield. And the one guy goes, "Big gopher," or something. The two farmers are standing there. He's the guy on the right. He's the guy that they actually modeled the face of Lothar after and stuff, which is kind of funny.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
He was like a journalist, and he did a lot of movies and stuff. He had the same kind of gigantism thing that Richard Kiel and Ted Cassidy and Peter Mayhew had and stuff. So yeah, they modeled the face of Lothar after him. That was kind of cool because he's the actual guy. Dave Stevens is actually in this too, which I didn't know. I learned this yesterday that the sequence when Howard Hughes is showing them he's about to show them that awesome animated propaganda film, that Max Fleischer looking thing. They show the Nazi jetpack kind of being tested, and Dave Stevens is the test pilot, which is kind of funny.
Oh, that's nice.
The guy that blows up.
Yeah, that was a again, one of the things that disappoints, that not disappointing, I guess more disappointing that we never got any sequels, is that I feel like there's such a bigger story here behind this story that I wish we could have seen more of.
Yeah, I would have loved to seen him battling like Nazi jump troopers and stuff. You know,
well, yeah, amazing. I mean, like from what I understand, like the, you know, him using the Mauser gun and all that, like, because there's that great shot of when he takes the Mauser gun, he's up at, right from the comic where he's up against the American flag, and it's like that's like the only time we see the fucking gun, and it's gone.
Go get him, kid. He doesn't even use it. Does he ever use it?
I don't think so. That's what I was thinking about.
The glass out. I think he shoots and misses, and the glass busts out, and that's like the most like badly placed glass on any kind of conveyance ever. Everybody's going out that window constantly and stuff.
But yeah, Timothy Dalton in this,
that's a great job.
Yeah, Timothy Dalton though, he's so he loves being, you can tell he loves playing a villain in this. Like he's just having a ball.
I love the there's a lot of little jokes in this that are little clever visual jokes and stuff. At the club, when Jenny's getting her, checking her coat to leave and everything, because Cliff told her, you know, run out and get a cab, get out of here and stuff. And Lothar comes storming in and he takes his hat off and he hangs it on this, like, he props it on this statue next to her of like a seahorse or something, a sculpture. And later on, when she beans him with the seahorse sculpture.
Exactly. And did I catch that? Oh, wow.
Like, it's kind of like, you know, foreboding or, yeah, whatever, forewarning that he's going to get beaned with this freaking statue. Sinclair at the end when he's leaving, he's like, oh, goodbye, you know, Miss Hollywood. And Cliff says, I don't think so. And like takes the gum off, you know, the thing. So he blows up, but he doesn't miss Hollywood. He hits the Hollywood sign like straight on, which I thought was kind of funny and everything. You know, it blows up the land part of it and stuff.
The gum was such, was such a funny thing too. Like that just becomes such a recurring element throughout this movie.
You know, so many movies they figure out what happened to the land part, yeah, and everything. The Valentine's, Eddie Valentine's the guy, and like kind of as a one off at the end, he says "Happy Valentine's Day, Eddie" or something like that when he's going to have the paratroopers like shoot him and all this, and like a Valentine's Day Massacre kind of riff. And, it's clever. It's a funny little movie. The script is so lean. It's like Back to the Future lean. Like there's everything just leads to the next thing. Everything, all these little motifs like pay off in spades all the time. Everything, the gum is like a big recurring thing. And Lady Luck, you know, and the chewing gum being lucky. Actually, I read up on Beeman's, the gum that they use and everything, and it's like in the 40s Beeman's gum was like traditionally lucky for pilots, apparently, because they would chew it to get their ears to pop in the changing, like when they're up in the altitude, they chew the gums for their ears to pop and everything. And it was advertised as having pepsin as a main ingredient. It was supposed to be, it was kind of sold as, which was not true, because pepsin was actually bad for your throat, apparently, I was reading, but it was sold as a motion sickness cure for like sailors and pilots and stuff. So they always chewed Beeman's gum. So Beeman's gum was literally like lucky, and Howard gives him like a pack of Beeman's gum at the end. And you know, whenever the gum is not present, bad things happen. Like on the GB that he's flying in the beginning, he sticks a piece of gum on the tail on the tail of the thing, and PB is like, oh, we just painted this thing. He picks the gum off, and of course the plane gets shot and crashes and screws up and everything. And then later on, you know, that goon is shooting, and I was trying to remember where the hole in the rocket pack came from that he puts the gum on. And it's in the scene when they fight they kind of wrest the guns away from the mob goons in the bar, and the bullet goes through the ceiling and the jet is up there, and the pack gets the bullet up there and everything. And so he gets the gum and sticks it on there again. The gum is good luck always. And when you take the gum away from Sinclair, you take his luck away. He blows up at the end. It's great.
I want to talk a little bit about Terry O'Quinn too, as Howard Hughes, because you know, one of the things people maybe know or don't know is that Tony Stark was heavily inspired by Howard Hughes back when, you know, Stanley and I think it was Jack Kirby who had done Iron Man with him. They based Tony Stark heavily on Howard Hughes. And I was watching this and I'm thinking, you know, man, back in the day, Terry O'Quinn could have made a pretty convincing Tony Stark as well.
Yeah. For sure. That's an interesting idea. Yeah. He's really good. I always knew him from Young Guns. You know, he was the lawyer, you know, McSween. Yeah. The lawyer that kind of like took them all in and everything. He's got such a great kind of paternal feel to him and stuff, even in this, you know, like in Young Guns, he's like the paternal figure to all of them. And once they lose him, they all go crazy, you know, and start blowing everybody away and stuff. And in this, it's kind of like, when PV meets him, they're kind of, it's kind of like your uncle and your dad getting together talking avionics and stuff. And then Cliff walks in and he's kind of like, you know, you got to let me use the rocket one more time. It's like talking to your dad and all this stuff. Terry O'Quinn's great. He's really good in this.
That paternal aspect is a good point too, because he also had kind of like that in Lost as well, right? He was kind of like the, it was like part paternal, but part sinister as well.
Okay. I have never seen an episode of Lost. I got it.
Oh, okay. It was a show.
I heard the ending was not so great.
Yeah. It had its ups and downs. It's one of those things that when you watch it, you get, it flows better if you're watching it, if you're like binging it, I think. When
you're not waiting every week.
Right. I think when you're waiting, then the payoff at the end is just very disappointing after all those years. But when you're binging it one after the other, it's pretty entertaining. Although, yeah, the ending is not that great.
Most things don't stick the ending that lasts them so many years and everything. Right. Like.
But he did have that like kind of paternal quality. He had that also in, and also with that sinister aspect too, in, there's this TV show, short-lived, only one season. It was called 666 Park Avenue. I'm not sure if you ever...
I remember that. I watched that. I liked it a lot. Yeah,
it was like that. It was an underrated gem. In fact, I got to see if I can track that down now that I think about it.
Yeah, now that I think about it, I was like, geez, did I watch all those? Because I did enjoy it when I was watching it. Yeah.
But yeah, he's great in this. Alan Arkin, too. Like, I always forget it's Alan Arkin until I hear his voice, because he looks so different from how I usually associate his look now.
He looks older than he does in later movies in this movie. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, they did him up really well and stuff. I always remember him from Gattaca as the cop and stuff. And of course, Catch 22 and everything. But which I guess is another big airplane movie, come to think of it. But yeah, he's good. I set up all the... Everybody does a great job. The guy from Blade Runner, who was the designer that they tracked down at the end to get them to Tyrell. He's in there in a little bit part. What's his name? Max Grodinchik from Deep Space Nine, that played Quark, is one of the FBI agents in the background and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned Clint Howard. Another Blade Runner connection, that his Neville Sinclair's apartment is Deckard's from Blade Runner. It's a Frank Lloyd Wright house. I noticed the tiles when I was watching it last time, and I was like, oh, those tiles all look really familiar. And it's Deckard's kitchen and everything. Yeah. It's a Frank Lloyd Wright house called the Ennis House in Los Feliz, and it's just south of Griffith Park, interesting enough. So he actually could do a jaunt and go get over to Griffith Park in time to meet the Nazis.
Well, yeah, you also got William Sanderson. He plays one of the aviation guys in a small part, which I did not even recognize him. Eddie Jones, who had played, you know, Pa Kent in Lois and Clark. Yeah, John Polito, yeah. The late great John Polito, in a great role as Bigelow.
Bigelow's great. He's so, like, he was in The Crow, right? He was the pawn shop owner, wasn't he? I think.
In fact, in the original comic book, James O'Barr had based that character on John Polito's likeness, and when they did the movie and they asked him, and they're asking him for like casting choice, like, I know you're not going to get him, but you should try and see if John Polito can play the pawn shop guy, and they're able to get him to do it. But yeah, if you go back and you read the original comic book, it's very clearly modeled after John Polito.
Oh, I gotta check that out again. I got that sitting on the shelf, Joe. That's funny. One thing I was gonna say, maybe that contributes to this, to the wholesomeness feel of this movie, the old-fashioned kind of wholesomeness feel. It feels like a code movie, even though it's not a code movie. But, like, I don't think you ever see any good people die. Like, I was watching this and I watched it, and then I thought about it towards the end, and I was like, well, I'm not going to rewind it and look again. But, like Bigelow is halfway good. Do you see him get killed? I mean, I know he dies. They say he dies. But, like, I think they kind of advance on him.
You see his body, but we don't actually see him actually getting murdered. Like, they advance on him, and then we see him dead in the next scene.
You see gangsters get killed, and you see Nazis get killed. You never see anybody good die. Even Bigelow is kind of like, he's kind of the mayor in Jaws at one point. When it's about to be a major catastrophe with like planes coming down, and he tells everybody to stay in their seats and everything because he doesn't want to lose. What's he trying to lose there? They've already paid admission. Let him go. You know, it's fine.
I don't know. Maybe he's just worried about reputation or something. Yeah. I don't know. It's weird, you're right. It is this movie. It's very much geared for a younger audience, which also makes it kind of surprising that it's,
yeah,
like when I think about it and how little action there actually is in this movie, it actually surprised me that it had captured my attention as much as I did when I was 8 years old.
I guess it's the ambiance. It's the feel of the movie itself, not mm-hmm. so much the action and everything. It really captures the place and time. I love the big hug bar. mm-hmm. that bar is actually over by, they kept, I don't know if it's the exact one, maybe it's a replica, but there's a bar over by me. I can't remember the name of it, but you go in the beer garden in the back and that pug is back there, that huge mm-hmm. kind of pug thing. You can take pictures in front of it and stuff. Yeah, it's very old Hollywood, very old old California, the orange groves he goes flying through at one point. I think she says her father is an orange grove farmer or something, and it's just very, again, it's nostalgic, but yeah, maybe gearing it towards younger kids that are even too young to be nostalgic for, that's being mm-hmm. asking somebody to be nostalgic for their grandfather's stuff maybe or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. But it's a good family movie in that in the real sense of family, you know, like a kid can kind of get stuff from it, and you know, there's stuff for the adults to enjoy too. So I really enjoy it. There's some great stunts. I don't know about the some of the flight sequences are kind of wonky looking, I guess, you know, the kind of, you know, you get that kind of blur around him when he's in the sky and everything. But the actual physical stunts, like when the plane crashes in the beginning, like I was trying to figure, was that some kind of mock-up or what? Because they really crash a couple of planes otherwise. Like it flies low and the car clips the landing gear off and it smashes into the ground and everything. It's really cool. Airfield gas trucks parked on the airfield do not fare well in this movie. They always get crashed into. He's got to have a shortage of fuel or something, because like cars are blowing them up and like biplanes are coming down on them. And that whole wing walking sequence is really cool when he's like they had to shoot a guy, I guess, with a mock-up parachute, mm-hmm. probably walking on the wing and dropping off and stuff. But there's the one where he slides down the whole length of the tail of the plane and kind of goes twisting off, and it's a great scene. He falls into a cloud, and then the cloud kind of looks like chook, chook, like there's lightning, but it's the engine kicking on, and then he comes flying out on the other end. Obviously it's the effects double coming flying out of the cloud, but it's a neat sequence, you know.
Yeah, there was some interesting choices too for the part of Cliff too, because they had a bunch of trouble finding someone who they felt was right for it. Apparently, and there are a lot of big names that were up for this. Kevin Costner and Matthew Modine were the first actors, but they were both unavailable. Dennis Quaid, Kurt Russell, Bill Paxton, Emilio Estevez, all of them auditioned. Johnny Depp was Disney's favorite choice. And yeah, Paxton said he came very, very close. D'Onofrio was
Tom
offered.
Hanks, the part. I heard.
Oh, really? I didn't see Tom Hanks. But yeah, D'Onofrio was offered the part and he turned it down. And
that's crazy. He's great as Robert E. Howard in he's one of my favorite actors. I love him.
Yeah, he's amazing. And then finally they chose Billy Campbell. Joe Johnston and Dave Stevens, they both felt Campbell was perfect, but Disney wanted an A-list actor. And Johnston eventually was able to convince Disney, and Campbell he wasn't a fan of the comics before, but when he started reading them, he fell in love with them. He styled his hair to be just like Cliff in the comic books too.
I've read that. Yeah, it reminded me of George Lazenby kind of coming in as James Bond for the thing, so he could get the part and everything. Yeah, he got his hair styled like Cliff in the comic. That's cool.
Yeah, yeah. He had also, you know, prepared for it, like listening only to 1940s music. He also had a fear of flying, but he was able to overcome it with the help of the film's aerial coordinator. And him and Jennifer Connelly, they actually began a romantic relationship on the set.
Yeah, that's neat.
And Johnson said that actually helped really a lot for their performances. And you can see that a lot. And speaking of those, you know, some of the differences from the comic, what I read too about, and you could tell me how accurate this is, but in the comic, Cliff is, you know, a little bit more of dickish in a way in his relationship. And you can see.
Yeah, enamored with him. I'm not as enamored with him as a hero in the comic as I am in this movie and stuff. He's more of a like aw shucks kind of Boy Scout kind of guy. Not really a Boy Scout, but I mean, yeah, he's a traditional, I got to save my girl kind of guy in this and everything. Mm. And yeah, he's a little bit like, let her, you know, she got herself into this kind of thing in the comic and stuff.
Yeah. So that's what I'd read about it. And yeah, they find a nice balance of it where he's got a little bit of that, like, you know,
he does get annoyed with her. Yeah. Like
he gets annoyed with her. Right. And, you know, he's always taking her to the same place all the time. And there's that great scene when, what's her name? Irma at the pug cafe after he offends her and she runs out and she's like, go on, go after her.
Go on, get her, you big dope. Yeah. Or something. Yeah. See, I mean, it's a good rapport.
Yeah. They do a good job of kind of softening those edges from the comic, at least from what I've read about the comic. And it's kind of, maybe it's because this movie wasn't very successful, but it does surprise me that Billy Campbell, despite there's so much talent in this film, so many well-known actors, and Billy Campbell is kind of the one who's had the least impressive career out of everybody.
Doesn't go on to much after that. Like I'm happy to see him as he was in Dracula, you know, he was Quincy Morris, I think, in Dracula. Wasn't he? Am I getting that right, or am I thinking of somebody else?
No, you're right. Yeah.
I feel it's one of those things like, oh man, I really wish that guy would have made it. You know, it's like, I mean, he made it. Obviously, I'm sure he's doing fine. He's doing better than me. But I liked him so much in this. You really want him to do well, you know, like and go on to bigger things and stuff. But
no, absolutely. He's done mostly TV since then. He does the voice on, I'm not sure if it's still running, on Disney's Rocketeer.
The one with the girl, the new one.
I haven't watched it either, but it's aimed for kids about 2 to 5. It only had one season. My daughter's 2 years old now, so I think I'm going to try and see if I can get her into it. Billy Campbell plays, so the main character in that is Kit Secord, a 7-year-old girl who receives the family jetpack, and she's next in line to become the Rocketeer. She's Cliff Secord's great-granddaughter, and her father, Dave Secord, is a stunt pilot, and he is voiced by Billy Campbell.
That's cool. I didn't know that. All right. That makes me more kind of interested in it, actually. Mm-hmm. That's a neat little connection to the original. That's cool. It's not a remake then entirely. It's like a, I guess, a requel, we call it, or something, huh?
Yeah, it's kind of like a continuation in a way, mm-hmm. which also there's been talks for years about doing a kind of continuation with this movie. You know, because Stevens and the screenwriters, they had actually envisioned this as the first movie in a trilogy. And Disney also hoped it would be very similar to the Indiana Jones franchise. Mm-hmm. Campbell and Connelly were contracted for sequels. But then those plans pretty much, you know, ended after the film's disappointing performance at the box office.
That's right, and up then, there with the Master and Commander and Remo Williams then for sequels you wish
but in 2012 Disney was starting to work on development on a remake or a sequel, and James Wan was involved at one point as a director, which he'd be amazing direct that.
Yeah, he's great.
But they were talking about, there are a few different ones, like a reboot sequel that takes place 6 years after the original with a black female pilot as the lead. The original plot was like Cliff Secord would have gone missing while fighting the Nazis, and then this black female pilot would have taken on the mantle.
Kind of like a Bessie Smith or something. That's really cool.
Something like that, totally. Yeah. There was also in 2020, it was announced that Ozzie Esquire had written a new draft of the film, and it was announced the return of the Rocketeer. David Oyelowo and his wife were serving as producers and
Get Out, right?
Yeah, I believe so. And then the plot would center on a former Tuskegee Airman who inherits the rocket pack and the uniform.
That's a great idea. It's an amazing idea.
But then, who was it? J.D. Dillard was set to direct, but just last year in November, he said he's no longer attached to the project because he wanted to take a breather from period aviation after he made Devotion. So I'm not sure what the status is with now. That's like the latest I found about it now. But
I like that African American angle is awesome. That was another question I had about this that I didn't voice. You know, not just like non Americans, but I wondered what African Americans thought of this, if it hit with them too, because like it's a pretty white movie. You know, I mean, I guess it's all white guys and stuff. It's very kind of like a white bread movie, I guess. But that's cool to hear that, like, you know, African-American artists were like keen on it and stuff. That's cool. Mm-hmm. And that's what the iteration of the cartoon, it must have evolved into the cartoon, right? Because the cartoon was a young African-American girl and everything, right? So
I believe so. I can't remember exactly, but yeah, I think so. Or mixed race or something like that. I don't remember. I have to look it up. But yeah, I think so. I remember from seeing some images here and there.
That's great. I'm glad because I love this movie so much. I like tell everybody to watch this. It's literally it's my favorite superhero movie. Even though like it's a superhero that only had what, like four issues or something, maybe.
Yeah. Know, yeah. Total, I don't know. I mean, it's a great movie. It holds up very well. I mean, again, like my biggest thing is just, I wish there was more of it. I wish we got to see more action, you know, and I think part of it is just the time it was made in, like, it, you know, because it's a time period when Hollywood's not really sure about superhero movies, so we don't want to use too much of him in the helmet.
The Punisher couldn't wear his skull and
right,
like,
right,
all the iterations on TV, like Daredevil was in all black and Thor was, he just looked like, I don't know, like he was in Man of War or something.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Very kind of self-conscious about the long underwear and all that, I guess.
Very much. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't really until Spider-Man that we went back to superheroes wearing their costumes in live action. Which makes sense for the time. And, you know, but like, that's where we got like the X-Men in black leather and all that. Batman was all in black rubber and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, I think this was one of those cases where they didn't really know what they had, I think. And
yeah,
obviously,
and people, I don't think audiences knew. I don't think most audiences even knew what they had. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's why the film was a disappointment at the box office. And it's only later that it developed this cult following. And I think if this movie was released now, like, first off, it would probably had a much bigger budget, probably have a much larger scale story, a lot more action in it. But then I think it would have gone on to have be much more well received.
Do you think part of it was because it was a Disney movie too? It had the Disney label on it, and Disney was kind of still in that era where people were like, you know, they thought of live action Disney movies as like, you know, the Cat from Outer Space and, you know, stuff. They were more into it was more known for animation, and they're kind of like, hey, Disney, stop making, you know, stop trying to make live action movies and stuff, maybe. I don't know.
No, that's a very good point. I think that probably also had an influence on public's perception of it, because, you know, especially if you look at some of the posters of it, it's very much kind of like that Walt Disney type of live action movie, which is like almost direct to video type of thing that you saw a lot of in the 90s. Yeah, their live action offerings were not very impressive back in those days, and this was really an outlier. So I think there's
stuff like that.
Right. Yeah. I think there's definitely something to that.
Yeah, that's a shame, because it really slaps. It's a great movie. I know, and everybody, I love meeting people that love it too, you know, because it's like you're sharing this thing that it's kind of like a club, you know, like a secret club or something. Little Orphan Annie's or something. I have no idea. But yeah, it's very fun to find, and just to find people to talk about and gush over this movie with, because it's wonderful.
Yeah. I mean, there's this one poster, and going out, because I think this is a definite, I'll show you the screenshot here. And I think this is definitely indicative of what people probably thought of it. Because if you look at this poster, and I remember seeing this poster in the theater, it's not at all impressive. It looks terrible. Yeah. And I think this is still like very cobbled together, and it does have with the big Disney logo on it so prominently, it does feel it doesn't look impressive based on this. Whereas, you know, the Art Deco poster, which we talked about, is amazing.
Arresting.
It looks so good.
It's a great image. Yeah, it's really cool.
And I think that's
kind of like
that would definitely had influence.
It's like chopped faces, and even Jennifer Connelly's expression. She looks very. It looks like a kids' movie. Yeah, it looks like this is only for kids, and nobody's going to enjoy this. But that's too bad.
But yeah, Any final things you wanted to mention about this movie?
Just that, like, what's fantastic about this movie is the best movies, I think, are called movies because they move you in some way and everything. I get so many, like, chills watching this movie and stuff sometimes. Like, that line you mentioned where Paul Sorvino turns on the Nazis is so great. And, like, where he's, like, when he's in front of the flag at the end and everything. And for them to be able to pull all those moments off, for Johnson to be able to pull all those moments off to get these big emotional reactions out of me in something that at the time, I was not invested in. It was a totally new thing. It was not like I came to this with nostalgia already for the character or something, like, oh, I'm going to see the Rocketeer and he's going to do this. You know, this is a new animal, you know, like, it's, and when I saw it in the theater too, like, all these big reactions, the Paul Sorvino line got such a huge, you know, like, practically a standing ovation, you know, and stuff. Mm-hmm. And for him to pull that off for something that's a completely, to me, like, a completely original creation with no, you know, this wasn't Star Wars coming back. This wasn't like, your favorite characters from, like, some IP that you already knew and stuff. To pull that off.
Right.
Character is a real accomplishment and stuff. The only time I've ever even seen this come close is, like, and this is gonna be crazy, but, like, a buddy of mine went, you know, blind to go see Real Steel, the movie with the boxing robots, and, like, we were like, this is gonna be crap, you know. But, like, the relationship and everything was played off so well and everything that at the end, when Hugh Jackman is throwing the punches and the kid is, like, looking at him with these loving eyes and stuff, the whole audience was, like, cheering. It's such a great theatrical, like, experience and stuff. That's the only thing I can attribute it to out of all the movies I've seen, you know, because, you go into a Star Wars movie, you're going to expect a lot of Star Wars fans to overreact to stuff and everything. And Marvel fans, on your left, everybody's going to blow up, you know. Avengers Assemble, you know, you're waiting for things to happen. With this, there's nothing to wait for, but it's still, you still get those moments. It's really cool.
Yeah, yeah. And I think if they find a way to bring this back, I mean, I think it's also so much more relevant now than it was even in 1991. Like, you know, we're seeing I'm like the resurgence. Right, exactly. We're seeing this resurgence of fascist idealization and all that kind of stuff. And it, especially when you compare it to what was happening in America back then, because, again, like I mentioned at the top of this, people forget that there was a lot of Nazi sympathizers in America. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite Jack Kirby stories is, you know, he was writing Captain America before the U.S. went into the war, before back at a time when being anti-Nazi was kind of controversial.
Yeah.
And you had these American... Right.
Yeah,
and you
had these Germany don't rock the boat. Yeah.
And there were American Nazis who called up Marvel's offices and they're like, we want to see this Jack Kirby guy who's, you know, this Jewish guy who's writing these Captain America comic books. And we're like, we're downstairs right now. Jack Kirby's like, okay, fine. He rolls up his sleeves and he goes down the stairs and then they run away.
Yeah. Yeah. He did the, didn't he do the Punch Out Hitler cover before we were at war with Hitler and everything, you know?
Yep. Came out about a year before.
There's a little bit of that in the scene when Cliff goes to the movies with Jenny and they go to there's that movie tone thing happening. And they're showing, like, Hitler assures, you know, the world that he's not amassing troops on the Czech border and all this. And, you know, Cliff is under his breath, like, yeah, right. And all that, you know, stuff. And, like, so it's kind of like he was still, yeah, Hitler was still kind of like an on top of the table kind of guy. You know, people didn't really like, They were like, some people were nervous of him, and the people who were paying the most attention were obviously speaking out against him, but a lot of people were not. Yeah, a lot of people were just like, oh, yeah, look at that Hitler guy. He's, you know, he's got those cool Hugo Boss outfits. I don't know what
you know, it never struck me until watching this last night, that theater scene, when I realized, I'm like, and everybody's like shushing him, and you think it's because, oh, well, he's talking in the movie, of course they're going to shush him. But now I realize, like, oh, wait, no, that was actually a controversial thing to say back then at that time.
Yeah. It was Disney shushing him. It was probably Walt Disney in the background.
There's a great documentary that Ken Burns did fairly recently called The U.S. and the Holocaust. I'm not sure if you saw it. It was airing.
I have that in my queue. I want to watch that. Yeah.
It's so good. It's so good. And it talks about a lot of this stuff and a lot of the Nazi sympathies going on during World War II. There was also Rachel Maddow also did a podcast fairly recently. I can't remember what it's called, but it was all about, like, the fascist sympathizers in America leading up to World War II. And then there's also Hitler's American Friends was a book that had come out recently. So this is a good time to re-explore some of this stuff. And I think it would be a really good thing to go back and bring this character back and to examine that period of life back then.
Yeah, for real. Yeah, you see it in a new light with the current events going on and everything, for sure. Like when he gives the line about when Sinclair is like, oh, she's like, oh my God, Neville Sinclair is, and he's like, what, a spy, a saboteur, a fascist, and all this, that and everything. You know, he just kind of revels in it and stuff. And, you know, there are guys that are out there in our society today that are, we got a lot of Neville Sinclairs running around, honestly.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you know. But yeah, I mean, great movie. If you're for some reason you haven't seen this movie, if it never landed on your radar, then best thing I could say is just, you know, go watch it. I'm very certain it's on Disney Plus. I mean, I've had the DVD for years, that's so where I don't know. I mean,
highest possible recommendation.
Yes, very good movie. It's very fun. And again, like the biggest downside I can say is just that there's not more of it, and I wanted there to be more.
Yeah. Good stuff.
Okay, Ed, but I think that's all we have to say about The Rocketeer. So why don't you tell people where they can find you and your stuff?
Well, I'm all over Amazon. I'm on Facebook much more than I should be. I got a blog, Delirium Tremens, is where you can find excerpts from my work and links to everything and news. You can get autographed books and stuff. That's emerdelac, E-M-E-R-D-E-L-A-C, at wordpress.com. You can find me there. And on Twitter, the usual places, you know.
Okay, great. So we'll have those links in the show notes. Make sure to check those out. Our website is superherocinephiles.com. Super Cinema Pod is the Twitter and Instagram handles. And if you sign up for our Patreon site, you get access to these episodes a week in advance with no ads. And also you get access to the Superhero Cinephiles book club. If you're part of the book club, then you may have already heard we're recording the movie episodes are far in advance. Actually very soon, I think maybe tomorrow or the day after, Ed is and I are going to be recording an episode for the book club. We're going to be talking about Unknown Soldier. By the time you listen to that will probably already be on the book club feed. But if you're not a member, you can go sign up for as little as $1 a month, get access to that and all the other episodes where we talk about comics and graphic novels. Thanks so much for listening, and we will talk to you next time. If you enjoy the Superhero Cinephiles, then you'll also love my companion podcast, the Superhero Cinephiles Book Club. All my Patreon subscribers get access to this exclusive podcast where I review superhero comics and graphic novels. Not sure what comics you want to read next or what you should dive into? I've got you covered on that. I'll be doing reviews, recommendations, and also talking to you about useful entry points if you're interested in reading some comics but don't know where you should start. Plus, you get access to all episodes of the main show a week before everyone else. On all of this for as little as just $1 a month. All you have to do is go to patreon.com/supercinemapod and you can sign up at any subscription amount to get started. Thanks so much for your support, and please don't forget to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for listening. And as always, good night, good evening, God bless.